What does growing up in a family with secrets do to a child?
I think I came to a similar conclusion in writing the book, is that it's not that uncommon for kids to grow up with secrets from their parents. And I was curious about what the impact is. You know, in a sense, it's almost a negative space, is that you don't know what the secrets are, but yet you're living in the midst of the secrets.
That's Paul Pitkoff. We talk with him about his book, Cold War Secrets. Then a woman is raped and finds a path toward healing by examining the objects associated with her trauma.
I began to think about what happened to me in relation to the material objects, the sweatpants, the linens that were taken from my apartment that night by the police, the night that I was raped. I had not thought about them in a very long time. It had not occurred to me. But hearing this other story really triggered what became a kind of ongoing, it was an over 10-year process of trying to figure out, you know, what happened to the objects that were taken in my case? What do the police do with those objects? And what is it about them that I found so profoundly alluring? And the book is really a kind of tracing of that story.
That's Laura Levitt. We talk with her about her book, The Objects That Remain. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I am host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. When Paul Pitkoff was 11, the FBI came to the door of his family's apartment in New York's Greenwich Village asking for his father. It took years for Pitkoff to find out the reason for that visit, a secret that lay at the heart of his family's life while he was growing up in the 1950s and 60s. In his memoir, Cold War Secrets, Pitkoff recounts his search to discover his parents' well-hidden secrets and learn how they shaped his identity, secrets that had to do with his father's involvement with the Soviet Union and then his rejection of it. Cold War Secrets also brings vividly to life the left-wing community in New York City during a time when being on the left could cost you your job, or worse. Paul Pitkoff is Emeritus Professor at Adelphi University. He's had multiple careers in education, film, law, and youth development. Well, Paul Pitkoff, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
You begin this book, Cold War Secrets, with a visit of the FBI to your home when you were 11. Was that the first that you realized that there were secrets that your parents had?
You know, when I look back at my life, I think I started to have some recognition that there were secrets from the time I was two or three. There's a story in the book where I think I was like about 3 years old, and I asked my mother if we could have a brother or sister. And she turned to me and she said, we would never want to have another child because we love you so much. And we don't want to share that, or something like that. And, you know, I was only three, so I accepted it. And maybe a month later or 2 months later, my father took me for a drive and he said, we're going to an airport. We went to this little airport in Brooklyn near Floyd Bennett Field. And this little DC-3 plane landed, and all these sailors came out of the plane, and they were throwing their hats in the air and everything. And my father pointed to the plane and all these sailors and said, "Paul, there's your brother." And sure enough, this 19-year-old man got into the car, and he was introduced to me as my brother. And at three, I went to nursery school and I told everybody that brothers come out of airplanes. And everybody laughed at me. And I think, looking back, that was sort of my first recognition that I wasn't always going to get the truth from my parents.
What was the secret that was revealed to you when you were 11 years old?
Well, when I was 11, a couple of things happened. Was It was actually a pretty difficult time for me in my life without knowing what was going on. It was when the FBI came to the house, and my mother said, when I asked why the FBI was there, and my sense was the FBI went after bank robbers. And so I was worried. And my mother said, I pestered her and I said, why are they here? And she said to me, oh, they just happened to be in the neighborhood and they dropped by. And at 11, I knew that was sort of kind of fishy, but I didn't know. I didn't know enough. I think by that time, I had kind of realized that if I asked questions, I didn't always get straight answers. So I think I just didn't bother asking. It was a silly answer. But so the point is that either I was in denial or I knew already that I wasn't going to get the answer. And when I was, I think, 13 or 14, we went on a trip across the United States. And it was a fantastic trip. We went on Route 66 and we saw cowboys. And I, at that age, I thought the trip was done just for me. And what was interesting is my parents were unusually happy with each other. My parents engaged in a lot of arguing when I was growing up. And so it was just a very pleasant trip. And it wasn't until I was, well, it wasn't until my father died and I was in my 30s that I realized that my parents hadn't been married until I was 14 years old. And it wasn't until I started writing the book that I found out that the trip across the country was their honeymoon. So there I was at 13 or 14 years old on my parents' honeymoon without even knowing it. And for instance, as I grew older, I knew that there was something going on. My father was, it was almost like he was the Manchurian candidate. Whenever communism was mentioned in the house or in the news, my father would become like a different person and he would become enraged. Almost nothing else could enrage him except the issue of communism. And I knew he was a very fervent anti-communist. And the thing that was strange is they sent me, my parents sent me to a school that was more than left wing. Many of the parents were members of the Communist Party or certainly favored. Many of the teachers and parents had been blacklisted. It was the midst of the McCarthy era. So it was that, I think, was the strangest thing for me to be immersed in an environment where everyone had a similar kind of political viewpoint, except for my father. And I think that as these inconsistencies built up or around secrets, that I became less and less assertive in trying to find out what the secrets were.
And why was that?
You know, my analysis is that part of it was shame. As I discovered late in my life, is my father, I think, felt shame that he had been so involved in the Communist Party. I learned when I did this book that he actually did some spying for the Soviets. And he turned against the Soviets in 1932 or 33. And I think the rest of his life, he felt that he had... he felt shame for buying into the ideology. And in some ways, I think I picked up that shame, not directly, but kids sense this kind of thing. And so I was kind of ashamed of my father in terms of his political beliefs when he became so reactionary. But the shame was more instinctive than intellectual. I really didn't know what I was ashamed about.
So now you have a secret brother. The FBI comes to your house. You're still pretty clueless. This is the McCarthy period, and you're going to the Little Red Schoolhouse for school. You know, the Little Red Schoolhouse in New York City in the Village, which, as you said, a lot of communists went to. What about your mom? What were her politics?
My mother's politics were always much more left-wing. She was a social worker. The milieu that she was in was very progressive. She wasn't a communist, but she certainly, I guess, believed in a lot of socialistic ideology, and she was outspoken about it. And looking back, it's really kind of interesting how my parents stayed together with such extreme political differences. My mother sometimes would feel shame in going to a social event with my father because she was always worried my father would start talking politics. The irony was that most people that met my father really liked him. I mean, he was a humanist in so many ways. But my mother had tremendous pressure, and she suffered a great deal of anxiety. She worked out of the home. She was a professional, and I think she didn't have many role models. She certainly didn't have any role models in her family, and there weren't that many women doing that in those days and taking care of a kid. And I know that caused her a great deal of tension. But nevertheless, her professional life was really very important to her. So she was balancing a lot of different things. And after I wrote the book or did the research for the book, I didn't realize how her anxiety around my father's well-being and my own well-being had some foundation in the sense that some of their friends, one friend of my father's was assassinated by the communists, and another friend who was a close friend of my parents, his wife and son were sent to the gulag in the Soviet Union because of his anti-communist activities. So I think her fear that we weren't totally safe was actually well-founded, or founded in some ways. And as a child growing up, I thought she was just crazy with all her anxiety.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Paul Pitkoff about his memoir, Cold War Secrets. It's about growing up in the 1950s and 60s among artists and leftists in New York's Greenwich Village, and the discovery of how his father worked for the Soviet Union, only to turn into an informant for the House Un-American Activities Committee. And yet your parents come across as really lively, interesting people. You describe them as risk takers, and you say that you are raised to question authority. In fact, your father told you, don't trust your teachers. And that can feel kind of destabilizing to a child, but it had its upsides.
Yeah, I think it did have its upsides in the sense that, not that I mistrust, but that I was open to different viewpoints. In fact, sometimes I think at this point in my life, I'm glad that, but sometimes I felt like I was missing out because I didn't have a dogma that I believed in fully. But on the other hand, it opened me up, and I think even in some of my work, it made me more successful because I could look at different points of view with more openness. And that certainly came from the family. And even with my parents' arguments about politics, there was an openness there too, because my mother could explain to me in private what my father's beliefs were, and even be positive about some of his reactionary beliefs. And my father could do the same about my mother. So they were fairly open-minded, and they were interesting. And it's interesting, since I did the book, I've talked to a couple of people that I grew up with who read the book, and we all came to the same conclusion. As little kids, we thought communists were interesting people. We didn't understand the politics, but they seemed to be writers and artists and very interesting people, which my mother was able to be in that circle and invite those kind of people over to the house. So I thought that was kind of natural. And it wasn't until I got older that I understood the politics.
And some of those really interesting people were people you also met at a summer camp, Camp Hurley. It had a really profound impact on you. Talk about this camp. I mean, it sounds very much like Camp Meadowlark that I went to when I was a kid, where I remember learning all these revolutionary songs, but having no idea about the revolutionary content of the songs.
It's true, because we were always marching to Pretoria, and I had no idea what we were doing with that. And we were singing all these Union songs, which really did have an effect. But I think when I first started learning them, I just liked the songs. The folk music was such a rich part of growing up and a very rich part of the camp. The camp was unusual. I talk in the book about it was markedly non-competitive. It was really an interesting experience for me because I think in our society, you can grow up your whole life and be immersed in competitiveness. And so to have an early start with a different kind of experience was transformative for me. When we'd play baseball, the camp took kids from underprivileged homes for the most part, and kids with all different kinds of physical disabilities and stuff. And we'd all play baseball together. And until I went to camp, baseball was all about winning. There was nothing else to it. And at Camp Hurley, we learned that, you know, we had to support people who maybe didn't have the same facility that we had. And if you were pitching to a kid who, you know, I had this one incident where I was pitching to a kid who couldn't run. He had some sort of problem with his leg. And I was admonished because I was trying to strike him out. And the counselor said, you know, you got to give him a chance to hit just like you. So that was very interesting for me. And also, I didn't understand it at that time, but it was a very interesting, this is in the 60s, the end of the 50s and the 60s. And there was very little gender segregation, is that girls and boys did almost everything together. We didn't sleep in the same bunk, but we shared the same bathrooms. We engaged in all the same activities. There was no gender discrimination there. And that was really an interesting contrast because I'd gone to a Y camp where they physically separated the boys from the girls. You'd have 2 hours a day where you could see a girl and the rest of the time they did their activities and we did our activities. So it was a very interesting camp.
It was also an integrated camp in the 1950s.
Yes. That was, I loved the camp and I stayed on to, it was basically one of the first jobs I had was being a counselor there. And so my first supervisor was an African American. And in those days, that was very unusual. And it was a wonderful experience for me. And the director of the camp made sure that he didn't typecast people's roles in the camp, like one of the guys who worked in the kitchen and worked on the slop line was a graduate student from MIT. So the whole thing about having roles and status and everything was all upside down. It was wonderful.
And then there came a point where your mother told you to look up the New York Times from October 13th, 1939. There was an article about your dad. Now we're back to the secrets. Tell us about that.
I was in college and I became the president of a fairly progressive political group. And interestingly, my father was supportive of that. But one day I was visiting home and my mother said to me, and she would do this in a casual way. She'd say, you know, now that you know how to use microfilm, why don't you look up this article about your dad? It's in the New York Times. So when I went back to school, you know, I was thinking about it, and my father was an electrician, and I knew he had worked on wiring the mast of the Empire State, and that's the only thing I ever thought, you know, would give him any kind of notoriety. So I just assumed the article was about wiring the mast of the Empire State. So when I opened the microfilm to the date, there was a picture of my father and a big headline, and it was all about his testifying at the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1939 and revealing that AMTORG, which was the Russian trading organization, was, as the Times headlined, and my father used those words, it was a beehive of Soviet activity. And my father was revealing what he knew about it. And let me tell you, that was a big shock to me. And because I was running this group, I was actually scared that people would find out that my father had testified at UAC. So I wanted to keep it secret, and connected with trying to keep it secret and my inability to, at that point, knowing much about history, I just sort of blocked it out and remains in denial. And I came home maybe a couple of weeks later, and I said to my mother, you know, how could Dad testify at UAC? Because I knew UAC in the 50s, in the McCarthy era. So I was really very filled with shame. And my father and my mother, in her inevitable way, she said to me, oh, they would have killed Dad if he didn't testify.
How reassuring.
And so, of course, I thought, well, that's just my mother making up stories again. But later on, when I was doing research about this, I learned that one historian calls it the veil of visibility, is if you turned against the Soviets, they could get you anywhere in the world. And one of the few ways you could escape is to actually go public. Because if you went public, supposedly they wouldn't want to assassinate you, because it would sort of legitimize what you had testified to. And so, in doing the memoir, I came back with less understanding of why he actually testified.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Paul Pitkoff about his memoir, Cold War Secrets. And so then, when was it that you decided to delve into the story and find out what happened?
You know, it was an interesting journey. I've always wanted to find out about it. And sometime, you know, there was this whole period where people were talking about recovered memory and all that. And I sometimes started thinking in my adult life, is maybe I made this all up about the FBI visiting, you know, that it's been so long, it was never really confirmed. My parents never talked about it afterwards. And so I'm not sure, you know, it was just one of those moments in life. I guess I'd lost my father had died, and it was a couple of years after that. And I had gone to law school and become a lawyer. And I think part of it is I just wanted to file something. So I filed a Freedom of Information request with the FBI. And I said, you know, is there a file? I'd like to see the file on my father. And, you know, a couple of weeks later, I got a form letter back that said there is no file on your father. And that really troubled me because I thought, well, gee, maybe I made this all up. And I had all these different feelings about it. But, you know, that's what the FBI said. And I didn't know what else to do. And one night I was having dinner with a crime reporter for the New York Post. And I told him the story about the FBI coming to the house and yet there's no file and everything like that. And I guess he was intrigued. And the next day he called me and he said he called one of his buddies at the FBI. And sure enough, there is a file on your father. And so then I persisted with that information, knowing that and sure enough, I got back a fairly lengthy file of the two visits to my house where they interviewed my father. And that started me on the trail to find out, you know, what the real story was, in a sense, to try to uncover all these secrets.
We'll let our listeners read the book to find out the secrets in detail. But I wanted to ask you, you know, I once was a student of family therapy, and one of the cardinal pieces of wisdom that we learned was about the toxic nature of secrets in families, that secrets cause dysfunction. So what was the impact of those secrets on your own development?
You know, that's a good question. And I think I came to a similar conclusion in writing the book, is that it's not that uncommon for kids to grow up with secrets from their parents. And I was curious about what the impact is. You know, in a sense, it's almost a negative space, is that you don't know what the secrets are, but yet you're living in the midst of the secrets. For myself, you know, it's harder to, I think certainly for me, it certainly made me more weary. In other words, I think whenever I'm in any kind of relationship or working with people, I always feel like there's something else, you know, that I'm not getting from the other side. And almost as if like everybody is keeping secrets that are important to me or important to knowing what the situation is. So it makes me, I know throughout my life, it's made me a little bit more hesitant and less confident because I wasn't really getting, as a child, I wasn't getting true feedback in terms of who I was. And I think the conclusion I came to in the book is that it tarnished my own ability to develop my own identity. I mean, this sounds complicated, but in some ways, because my parents couldn't be truthful about who they were, mm-hmm. I think I had a harder time accepting who I was and forming my own identity. I don't know if that makes sense. I don't know if I can positively attribute that to my early life experiences with the secrets.
It makes a lot of sense, actually, because you're describing a shifting ground as you grew up, that what something that you were aware of was not acknowledged. And it's very hard to form a clear identity on shifting sands like that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I think that's what I actually talk about that in the book. And I think that the other thing that is very hard, even as an adult, is to accept that my parents, unwittingly at least, I don't think it was all that conscious, but what comes out is that they didn't trust me. I can understand, because of all the political stuff my father was engaged in, that they might not reveal that when I was a child, because it could actually, in the McCarthy era, put us all in danger. But not to reveal it to me when I was in my 30s or 40s is a whole different story.
And so now, how has finding out about your family's secrets changed you and the way you see them and yourself?
Well, in many ways, it's been a very positive experience. I think that I wish they were still alive, because in some ways I could tell them that I accept what they had to do. In other words, that I'm not angry at them as I was earlier in my life when I realized that there were so many secrets that it kept. And I think I ended up feeling more in admiration of them. I mean, it sounds inconsistent because of my anger about the secrets, but they had, like so many people, they had a complicated life. They started with very little support in their lives, and they made it through. And they certainly had an interesting life. They included me in many parts of their life that was really interesting. And in some ways I actually feel sorry for them that they couldn't have had the strength to reveal some of these secrets about their lives when I was an adult. I'll conclude this thought with an interesting thing, which I found in the book, is that my parents left cartons of papers and stuff. And on one of the envelopes, my father scribbled on the envelope how essential it is to pass on to the next generation your life story, so that somebody knows where they came from. And I just thought that was the height of irony that my father would write that and not do it. And so in a mystical way, is I feel like, well, I carried on what he had hoped to do and didn't do, at least the memoir. The process of writing the memoir did something that he actually thought was a good thing to do.
Paul Pitkoff's book is Cold War Secrets, Unscrambling the Certain Uncertainties of Family Secrets. Next up, dealing with the aftermath of trauma through the objects that remain. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. One evening in 1989, Laura Levitt was raped in her own bed. Her landlord heard the assault taking place and called 911, but the police arrived too late to apprehend her attacker. When they left, investigators took items with them, a pair of sweatpants and the bedclothes, and a rape exam was performed at the hospital. But the evidence was never processed. Decades later, Levitt returns to these objects, viewing them not as clues that will lead to the identification of her assailant, but rather as a means of engaging traumatic legacies writ large. The objects that remain is equal parts personal memoir and an examination of the ways in which the material remains of violent crimes inform our experience of trauma and loss. Laura Levitt is professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University, where she's chaired the religion department and directed both the Jewish studies and the gender, sexuality, and women's studies programs. Laura Levitt, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
So this book, The Objects That Remain, you write that the story is about trauma and loss and how material objects embody the suffering of that trauma and loss. You also say it's a tale of life after such violence. So tell us about what happened to you that led to writing this book.
So I guess the place to begin is to say in 1989, I was a graduate student studying theology at Emory University. And I was raped in my apartment, and the man who raped me threatened to kill me. And those events really did sort of change my life. And so I returned to that story many years later as I began working on this project, in part because I heard the story of another woman who had been brutalized and actually killed, a woman who had been murdered. And I heard the story of a belated trial in that case, where over 30 years later, the clothing that this woman had worn the night that she was murdered showed up in court. And hearing that story about this other woman, I began to think about what happened to me in relation to the material objects, the sweatpants, the linens that were taken from my apartment that night, the night that I was raped by the police. I had not thought about them in a very long time. It had not occurred to me. But hearing this other story really triggered what became a kind of ongoing, it was an over 10-year process of trying to figure out what happened to the objects that were taken in my case? What do the police do with those objects? And what is it about them that I found so profoundly alluring? And the book is really a kind of tracing of that story.
Yes. And before getting back to your story, it's not just about the objects that were involved in what happened to you, but also in general, objects, relics of the Christian martyrs, concentration camp uniforms at the U.S. Holocaust Museum. You know, I was struck about that one. You said that an aura emanates from those articles of clothing. And I remember going to Buchenwald in Germany and also being just overwhelmed by the aura that emanated from the entire place, as well as from the objects that are in the museum there. So I wonder if you could talk about objects as witnesses as you explore in this book.
Yes. So part of what I think happens is that objects are, they take up space, right? And they were there then and they are here now. And part of what is so powerful about them is that they hold traces of that time and that place. So when we think about those prisoner uniforms, the uniforms were worn daily, day in and day out. And so they take on the form of the people who wore them. And so I think thinking about drawing historical connections between something that happened in the past and something in the future, we often think about witnesses being the people who were there. And as we know, so many people died in the Holocaust. And those who did survive and who have survived are also aging at this point. And in part, objects are some of, and places are some of the ways in which we make those connections in time and in space. And I think that that's part of how they witness for us, because they carry the traces of that time. And it's a kind of affective engagement that we feel them, right? And that's part of why I ended up writing in part about relics, or about the sort of talismanic or the holy aspect of these objects. And so I think that it's really powerful to consider these qualities that are not so easily in our control.
Yes, and there was a little tone there. The holy aspect of those objects, is that what you said?
Yes, I did.
So Laura Levitt, your case, the rape case, was closed almost as soon as it was opened. Many years later, you went back looking for the documentation, looking for the evidence. What had happened to it?
Well, from what we can surmise, it was lost. It's clear that the rape kit from the night of the rape was never processed. And the understanding that I got, I put in a request for information and waited a couple of months to hear. And then finally, I called the Atlanta police and asked them to tell me what happened. And after getting moved from one, it was a cold call, so I went from one office to another. And finally, I got to a sergeant in sex crimes. And I seem to have gotten to the right person. This was a woman who said to me first thing when I said my name, she said, "Funny, I have your case file on my desk. My partner and I have been looking for your evidence." And so that was a kind of amazing moment, because I had really thought for a very long time that there was nothing left. In fact, I thought the book might end with a chapter that was "Nothing Remains." But instead, I had this very thoughtful policewoman who was willing to talk to me, and she answered many of my questions. But what she told me is that from the period from the time that I was on the phone with her in 2014 and when I was raped in 1989, police storage facilities had changed a couple of times in Atlanta. There were about three different moves. And so my evidence could have been lost in any one of those moves. But in the process of talking to me, I was able to discover that they had indeed retested material evidence from rapes and murders from as far back as the 80s. In the early 2000s because of changes in DNA. So she really did tell me a lot of things, the statutes of limitations, et cetera. But alas, in my case, she was never able to find the evidence at all.
One of the things, however, that did remain in the case file, or I'm actually not sure if it did remain or not, it was a pair of jogging pants, a photo of a pair of jogging pants that was left on the floor beside your bed after you were raped. Is that correct? And the reason I'm not clear is you also talk about missing the photograph, but it was in your file. So how did you miss it? How did you see it? What happened there?
So after I got off the phone with the sergeant in sex crimes, I all of a sudden realized that she had told me that she had my case file. And so I immediately emailed her after I got off the phone, and I asked her if she would send me a copy of the case file, which she did. And I have to say that I was not prepared to look at that file. Instead, I was so unnerved by what was there. There was my statement to the police, which at the time was not digitized. So they had someone type my statement. And then they gave me the type statement, and I was able to amend it with my handwriting. So I saw my handwriting on this form, and that was unnerving. And then there were also photographs that were taken of me the night of the rape. one of my wrists and another of my face and my bruised neck. I was choked. And I was so unnerved by seeing those documents and those photographs that I somehow missed what I call the sweatpants. I was looking for them and I didn't see them. And it was only when I was editing the book in 2018 that I went back and went into the file again. And I was only then really able to see that there was indeed a photograph of those jogging pants. And I had literally missed it. And I think it's about how trauma works, you know, that I just was not, I was not in a position to really see them until I came back to them 4 years later.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Laura Levitt about her book, The Objects That Remain. It's both a personal memoir and an examination of the ways in which the material remains of violent crimes inform our experience of them and our thinking about trauma and loss. So the trauma, I mean, we've kind of danced around it a little bit. And in fact, you talk about this process of circling around trauma from the outside in as part of the process of well, processing it. So talk about that. And you also liken it to how a murder investigation or investigation of a crime happens.
Right. So at a crime scene, they begin at the very furthest ends of the space, right, and slowly circle in. And I think that I use the language of holding because I talk about holding all the objects in police storage and in places like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in terms of their archive. But holding is also kind of, you know, holding back too. So I think that there's a kind of you dip your toe in slowly. I'm not someone who jumps in quite that way in the water. So I think I had to kind of prepare myself to do this work. So one of the things that happened in terms of the process of writing the book is I began by wanting to learn about what police do with material objects in their possession. So I did some research and I spent some time trying to figure out what they do. And I discovered this professional organization that engages in police property management. I met the gentleman who started the organization. And I was able to join. And then I eventually took a course with the police to learn what they do. And that was before I even addressed anything of my own. And so I think I had to kind of get a good sense of the lay of the land in order to make my way in. And if you had talked to me early on when I and asked me what the book was about, I would say, well, it was about objects held in police storage and objects held in Holocaust collections. And I didn't really talk about my own case. That was really hard for me to do. It was much easier to begin by talking about these larger structural arrangements, these practices. And it really took me a while to then really talk about my own story. This also happened in the readings of the two beautiful texts that, or three texts that I write about in the first section of the book, the Holocaust memoir, The Hair with Amber Eyes, which is an incredibly powerful and moving and beautifully written memoir by Edmond Dabal about his family and all of the objects that they lost. And he tells the story through objects. And then the other was really engaging with the poet Maggie Nelson's work, Jane, A Murder, her book of poems. And then I turned to Maggie Nelson's memoir, The Red Parts, which is about the trial in her aunt's case, this belated murder trial 35 years after her aunt was murdered. And so engaging with their stories, again, was a way of both understanding how they were able to tell their stories. They also provided profound companionship. I really found it so moving to engage with their works and was so grateful to have their models and to learn with and from them and to kind of keep company with them. But I was doing that in part to tell my story, but it took me a while to finally, you know, tell my story, building on what I had learned from them.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word beauty, which you also talk about in this book, and yet you're dealing with objects that represent so much ugliness. Talk about the relationship between, you know, the objects of beauty, of memory, and the objects of trauma.
Well, I think in part we have containers or holders of memory, right? And I think about how a reliquary works, right? So often the relic could be something that is, you know, a bone or a lock of hair or a bloodied garment or a soiled garment. And yet we house those objects in very beautiful containers. That's kind of how a reliquary works. And then the reliquary, which holds the relic, also carries some of the traces of the liveliness of the relic itself and becomes a kind of secondary relic. And I think about those beautiful texts by Maggie Nelson and Edmund Duval as themselves a kind of beautiful container, so that powerful writing can be a way of holding those memories and telling their stories. So I think there is a kind of ambivalence here. When we think about that which is holy, it can be awe-inspiring and scary, but also really powerful and compelling and beautiful and comforting. But I think it has those ambivalences built into it.
Yeah. And Laura Levitt, you write in The Objects That Remain, you know, kind of continuing on this theme, that you say, we keep writing, trying to breathe new life into traumatic pasts, pointing to different futures. So could you talk more about how writing about these, writing this book and writing about these objects, how did it lead to, at least to some measure, of healing your wounds?
Well, I think that, you know, part of what I wanted to get at is the way in which we live on. I think people think about people who've been violated or traumatized or hurt in profound ways as victims in particular ways. And we don't understand that we have lives that continue. And so I wanted to write about living on. And I think that we continue to integrate these stories into our lives over and over again. It's not like we tell the tale once and we get it right and we're done with it. But rather, as we grow and change, we come back to these stories in different ways. So in the book, I talk about having written about my rape early on in particular ways, but then hearing about these material objects and thinking about the material objects in my case brought me back to that story in a very different way. And so I think that storytelling is animating and engaging, and it helps us keep living on and breathing on. And I think about these as kind of iterative practices. They are repetitive. We continue to breathe, and we continue to engage, and they're never the same. I'm a scholar of religious studies, and we think about sacred texts. In many traditions, we have cycles of reading the same text, you know, each year over and over again. And the texts are the same, but they're also different, right? Because they speak to us at different moments in of our lives in different ways. And I think that trauma is a part of who we are. It doesn't go away, but we engage with it in different ways over time. And that can be really empowering and powerful and, you know, healing in certain ways. It's not like, well, and now you're over it, but we live with it and we come to terms in different ways.
You also write in this book about concepts around justice and blaming the victim. Your case never went to trial. So what does justice mean for you?
So I think we're all, you know, in American culture, we're so used to seeing justice played out in a courtroom drama on television and movies. I mean, we're just inundated with it. I think most of the after-school specials I grew up with as a child seemed to take whatever the social problem was and kind of put it into a courtroom and fix it. But life goes on after trials. And I didn't have a trial. And I think that what justice is being acknowledged and recognized and heard. And so For me, that's the most important thing. And my hope is that in the ways in which I began to feel heard and seen because I could identify with some of the ways in which other writers were writing about traumatic legacies that they experienced was really helpful to me. I'm hoping that my book might open up a space for others to also be able to engage. And, so justice is not from on high, or, you know, it's not the courtroom, and it's not theological either. It's not sort of God at the end of days. That's not particularly compelling to me, although I understand that both those forms of justice can be very meaningful to other people. And I am certainly not prescribing what other people should experience. So let me be clear about that. But in my case, I think this idea of being recognized and heard and acknowledged. We do this through critical engagement, through writing, through performance, through art. And I think that that's a way of doing justice. It's not a passive activity. It's an engagement that is empowering. The question about victim blaming is really also about the question of control. So I think that for me, one of the challenges was, you know, you keep running through that night in your head. I should have double checked the back door. I should have, the first time I heard a sound in my apartment, instead of going and looking, I should have run out the front door. And, you know, that's a very tempting story to tell. But the logical conclusion of that story is, if only I did these things, therefore it is then my fault. Because if I had done those things, then I would not have been victimized. I would not have been violated. And yet, I don't think it works that way. I think that there are things that happen to us in our lives, like my rape, that are out of my control or out of our control. And I think we have to be very careful about the temptation, because we so long for control, the temptation of leaning so heavily on it that we blame ourselves.
Mm. Yeah, and you also, well, as you mentioned, you're a scholar of religion. When you were raped, you say that you both lost your faith in God and your faith in the state. Now, in light of all that you've just been talking about, in reasserting control, in reasserting control at the same time as acknowledging your helplessness in a way that's, I think that's what you're talking about to some degree. Where does your faith lie now?
Well, it's a funny thing. In part, I would say that using the language of relics is a way of reminding myself that those objects that are so compelling are also out of my control, right? That they have properties that that I can't kind of pin down. And so that recognition, I think, is one form of material religion that I have come to believe in. In addition to that, I write in the last chapter of the book about wonder and about, again, the lack of control, which is not only about helplessness, but it's also about humility, humility in the face of things that we can't really explain. So in the process of writing the book, there were so many times where I felt like I had talked to the right person at the right time, like getting to that sergeant in sex crimes, or there was a moment where I was speaking to the conservator at the Holocaust Museum, and I was trying to explain what my project was. And I started talking about the police, and all of a sudden she told me what the FBI does with evidence and how it's different from what she does. And I was just so surprised that this this conservator, this very powerful woman who does this incredible work at the Holocaust Museum, knew about what the FBI does and really understood what my project was. And so those signs from the universe, which is one way of talking about it, or wonder, just really did propel the project and kept me going. And I believe in that as a kind of things that I can't explain, right? I can't pin them down. So there's helplessness, but there's also humility and wonder that really have become very important to me.
Well, that is such a beautiful note to end this interview on. Laura Levitt, the book is The Objects That Remain, and I want to thank you so much for sharing this book with us today.
Thank you, Francesca. This has been a delight to talk to you. I really appreciate this.
Laura Levitt is professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University, where she's chaired the religion department and directed both the Jewish studies and the gender, sexuality, and women's studies programs. In addition to The Objects That Remain, she's the author of three previous books in Jewish studies. We have a little time left, so how about I read one of the passages from The Objects That Remain that I bookmarked. When Laura Levitt was raped, she was in a relationship with a potter. Handling his pots in the days after the attack, she found a small measure of comfort. So here's the passage. I put my faith in the poet's and the potter's hands. Writing, like making new pots out of old clay, helps contain brokenness and can even make it beautiful. Over these many years, I have crafted many words to contain my pain, none of which are definitive. We keep writing, trying to breathe new life into traumatic pasts, pointing toward different futures. We also have other containers for the brokenness, gifts, Maggie Nelson's glass box, Edmund Duval's Netsukes, My Pots, to remind us of the passage of time. We can be surprised by what comes after we put these gifts to different uses, a repurposed medical cabinet, a decommissioned vitrine, the collections they hold. Objects make the past tangible, but they cannot erase the break. There's no going back to what had been, but we need to keep telling stories. Objects hold out the promise of finding something of ourselves, and if we're lucky, we may find our voices in the narratives of others, making all of us less lonely and the world, perhaps, more beautiful. That was a passage from Laura Levitt's book, The Objects That Remain. Next week on Writer's Voice, don't miss our interview with world-renowned climate scientist Michael Mann about his terrific new book, The New Climate War. It's about the campaign by fossil fuel interests to distract and deflect the public from the climate emergency and to divide and discredit the climate action movement. It also shows us how to fight to take back our planet from those who would destroy it. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.